If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Monday, June the 15th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guests today joining me via Zoom are David Brady and Doug Rivers. Dave Brady is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a longtime political scientist and lecturer at both Stanford University and Stanford's Graduate School of Business. Doug Rivers is a Hoover Institution senior fellow and a Stanford University political scientist. He's also the chief scientist at YouGov PLC, a global polling firm. Gentlemen, great to have you on the podcast. And who'd have thunk it? The three of us were able to figure out how to get on Zoom together. Miracles never cease. So the screaming news today, political-wise, is this poll that came out, a Canadian polling firm that had the race, the Biden-Trump race, at 14 points, which is a shock poll, a shock in all capital letters. It's a poll of 1,500 voters, registered voters, I would have had, so I don't want to get too deep into that poll. But let's talk about some other polls. The most recent Wall Street Journal, NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, for example, has Biden up by 7 over Trump. Washington Post, ABC News poll, these are all polls in early June, by the way, has it as a 10-point race. A Monmouth poll has Biden up by 11. CNN, in a poll that the Biden campaign threatened to sue CNN over, I'm not sure how you sue someone over a poll, but they threatened to do it. They have the race at 14 points, 55 to 41 is the spread. Doug Rivers, you do polling for a living. I want your thoughts on that with this in mind. A double-digit race. I went back and did some homework, Dave and Doug. The Obama victory in 2008, he wins that race nationwide by a little over 7%. George H.W. Bush in 1988, he wins 40 states, but the popular vote spread is just under 8%. Ronald Reagan wins 44 states in 1980 by almost 10%. FDR wins 42 of 48 states in 1932. The popular vote spread is 17.5 points. I think the three of us can agree that a double-digit lead for Biden, which translates into a double-digit victory, is nuclear Armageddon for the Republicans. Doug Rivers, should Republicans be headed for their fallout shelters right now?
Not yet. It's as our dean once said to us, it's not yet time to panic, man. The polling for Trump has been miserable in the last few weeks, with a set of these polls, fairly reputable polls like CNN and ABC, Washington Post, with double-digit leads for Biden. Those are nonetheless outliers. The polling average is running at about plus 8. At YouGov, we've done two surveys in the last week, one for The Economist that had Biden up by 8, mm-hmm. one for Yahoo, which had him up by 9. Part of the problem is what Nate Cohn of the New York Times likes to refer to as high-quality live interviewer polls are extremely susceptible to blips like this. The ABC Washington Post poll 2 weeks before the 2016 election had President Hillary Clinton leading Donald Trump by 13 points, I believe. When you do a telephone poll, you get whatever sample you get on that day, and they tend to bounce around because you don't have the ability to control your sample. Most of the online polls are done using panels where you're talking to the same people, so you can control the composition of the sample so it doesn't bounce up and down each week. This Canadian poll, I just looked it up. I'd never heard of the guys until about 10 minutes ago when you mentioned it to me, uses a thing called Lucid, which is a sample. It's what's in the trade called a river sample. So they're interviewing people, that's getting a little nerdy, by running ads on the internet and taking whoever shows up in the period in which they're interviewing. So it's got all the problems of the phone polls compounded by an unknown set of people I'm answering on the internet. Why would that generate these enormous Biden leads? And I agree with you entirely. But if Biden were to win by 14 points, it would be a landslide. The reason for this is Trump has had an extraordinarily bad month. He's gone from one catastrophe to another. And the result of that is Trump supporters don't think it's that entertaining to participate in polls. And so we're seeing the typical bump when the news is very negative on a candidate. They're going to do worse in the polls than they actually end up doing.
Right. So it's interesting, gentlemen, if you look at the Real Clear Politics average, which Doug mentioned was plus eight, that is correct. You start going back into the individual polls that RCP bases its average on. You have to go back to Friday, April the 10th to find a poll in which Trump either wasn't trailing or was running even. That was a Fox News poll. I think it's done by your friend Darren Shaw, if I'm not mistaken. And that had the race at 42 all, but then 5 days later, some sketchy outfit called YouGov, the Economist YouGov poll, came up with a poll that had Joe Biden up by five. And so it's been. So without getting too deep into the weeds of this race, because I want to get Dave in this conversation in a minute, Doug, just it quickly goes from even to five and away we go. So how did Trump get stuck in this situation?
Well, he's been trailing pretty consistently, for the last 6 months, but he's been trailing by an amount that looks relatively similar to the 2016 election. The last month, 117,000 Americans have died from COVID, and there's rioting in the streets, and Trump has not handled this at all well. So it's completely believable to me that Trump has had a 3 to 5 point decrease in his polling on the trial heats. 10 points, if true, would be a remarkable shift.
Right. Now, Dave Brady, if you look at the RCP averages, not for the national race, but the battleground states, you find bad news for Trump in Michigan, where Biden, per the RCP average, is down by seven. But you look at Wisconsin, Florida, Pennsylvania, Arizona, North Carolina, where Trump is even. In those other four, though, Wisconsin, Florida, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Biden has a lead of no more than 4 points, which suggests game on. It's a good time now, I think, for you, Dave, to remind the audience that it's not a sum of the parts election. It's a parts of the sum. In other words, we do electoral votes, not popular vote. But tell us, Dave, what you're looking at when you look at battleground states right now.
Well, so I want to make 2 points. When we look at when we look at the battleground states, or even in the big picture that Doug was talking about, there's the base of both parties is pretty much, we know they're going to vote Republican, Democrats vote Democrat. But there are some Democrats that switch and vice for the Republicans. There are some Republicans who vote for Biden. So when I look at these data, I break it down by, among the Republicans, sort of three ideological groups: the very conservative, which is about 33% of the party, people who say they're conservative, self-identified, and people who say they're moderate, that's about 26%. And for the Democrats, very liberal, 25% liberal, 35%, and about the same for moderates. But and the point of this is, when you go into the battleground states, the national distribution sort of isn't there. I'll give one example. There's a whole bunch of states that are sure Democratic states. And when you break it down into those states, California, New York, Illinois, et cetera, Biden's ahead 56-33.
Right.
So let's go back to when you look at the 11 states that are most people say are the battleground states, In those states, it's good news for Biden. He's up. He's not up by 7 or 8 points, but he is up by 3 or 4 points across those 11 battleground states. Then when you add, there's some other states, five states like Iowa and Ohio, people don't call them, but you can put those states in, you get to 16 battleground states. And in those states, Trump is still losing to Biden, and that's the first time that's happened in those states. Now, I'm just aggregating them at this point, because I'm just using Doug's YouGov sample. But What's best news for Biden is this. For the first time, there are more Republicans in the battleground states saying they're going to vote for Biden than there are Democrats saying they're going to vote for Democrats saying they're going to vote for Trump. And it's interesting because if you look at it, the Republicans who say they're going to vote for Biden are moderate to conservative and some conservatives. On the very conservative, if you say I'm a very conservative Republican, 99% for it. Nobody's voting for Biden. And the interesting thing was Biden had to worry about people coming at him on two sides. One, the Bernie Sanders voters who in 2016, 15, 20% did not vote for Hillary. Either voted for a third party candidate, didn't vote, or someone voted for Trump. And that hurt. So you had to worry about where the very liberals are going to come. And then what about the moderates?
Right.
They don't like that. But the interesting news for Biden in this case is the very liberals and the liberal in the battleground states, they are not going for Trump.
Right. So the Trump campaign will push back Dave and Doug with two things. Number one, they'll say, you look at these various states, we are better organized than the Democrats are at this point. We ran there 4 years ago. We've had 4 years to plan this out. We know where our people are. And then secondly, they point to a thing called voter enthusiasm. Have your polls detected any kind of enthusiasm gap between these two candidates? Because you hear this phrase coming up more and more. Republicans are more excited about their guy than Democrats are excited about their guy at this point.
If you put the question that way, I think that's right. But if you ask, are Democrats excited about getting Donald Trump out, then I think the enthusiasm is pretty high. And that result was interesting because the very liberal, I'm going to give you an example. In surefire Democratic states, only 86% of Democrats say they're going to vote for Biden for sure. 14% say they'll vote elsewhere, and that's the very liberal. But they don't matter because California is going to vote Democratic irrespective of what happens. So for Biden, it's pretty good news that all he has to really worry about is the moderate to conservative Democrats. And that's the first time he hasn't been getting it from both sides.
All right.
State level polling has really moved in Biden's direction over the last few months. People look at the states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, which are really must-win states for Democrats, and Biden has had, in some polls, up to double-digit leads in Michigan, a state that he narrowly lost in 2016. Pennsylvania is more in the 3 to 5 point range for Biden. But the remarkable thing is there are a whole bunch of states that are must-win states for Trump. For example, Florida or Texas, where you've got Biden even, or in the case of Florida, running ahead. The White House, amusingly, in response to this CNN poll that they threatened to sue them about, quoted a poll from Arkansas that had Trump ahead by 2 points in Arkansas. If Trump is having to run a campaign in Arkansas, that shows you how bad things would be for him.
He's going to lose 40. He's going to lose 40 states if he wins Arkansas by 2 points.
By the way, I want to add
that's that right.
Most surprising thing I found was I looked at the states, 16 to 18 states that are surefire Republican, Idaho, Arkansas, Louisiana, they're going to go Republican. And Trump's lead in those states over Biden is only 3 points.
Let me throw a theory at you guys. And as political scientists, you feel free to laugh at this theory. But the theory goes as follows. This is, if you think of this election as a piece of software, we're now in version 3.0, only halfway into this year. And version 1.0 would have been Trump running on the economy with Biden basically conceding the economy to Trump. Maybe he could talk about rich-poor divide, but basically saying, okay, he's going to get the economy argument. I'm going to run on basically on the theory that America needs a mental health break here. It can't take 4 more years of this guy. Then along comes COVID. And now election 2.0 emerges, and it's you can't trust Donald Trump in a time of crisis. Look how he's botching this situation. But now in the last 2 weeks, gentlemen, I'd say we're into 3.0 territory, and that's the issue of race and policing and societal divides. Yet another wrinkle in this campaign. Do you buy that premise?
Well, it certainly has changed the topic for a bit. My guess is that we're not over COVID. The number of deaths happening and the increases in some places suggest to me that that's still going to be an issue in the fall, whereas it's less clear to me that the race issue doesn't settle down a bit.
Mm-hmm. Dave Brady, where were you in 1968?
In 1968, I was at the University of Iowa.
Do you remember that election year?
I certainly do. I do indeed. I sat it out.
You were wrong, Doug. He does remember. You lose that bet. Yeah. Okay, I'm joking. The man has a short memory. I'm mentioning 1968, Dave and Doug, for this reason. I went back and looked at the timeline for that incredibly tumultuous election year, and it was just relentless in that January the 30th of 1968, the Tet Offensive begins. March 12th, the New Hampshire primary, where Lyndon Johnson, quote unquote, loses. He got 48% of the vote. He beat Eugene McCarthy by 6 points, but he loses in the expectations game. March 31st, LBJ goes on national TV and says he won't seek another term. April the 4th, just a few days later, Martin Luther King is assassinated. June the 5th, RFK is assassinated. August 22nd through 28th, the Chicago protest police scuffle. Were you there, Dave Brady, for the police riots?
I was not.
Okay. You're wrong on that too,
Doug. Guess on that, Dave.
Yeah, I'm sure of that.
Okay. October 16th, 1968, the Black Power salute at the Summer Olympics. It's probably pretty handy for Richard Nixon running on the idea of America having just kind of lost itself.
Carlos.
Right. Then November the 5th, Election Day. Now, we look at 2020, gentlemen, and in terms of the tumult, I would trace it back to March the 9th, which was the first of several black events on Wall Street, the Black Monday, the Dow drops 2,000. You go through March with the president giving a national address. The following day, you have Black Thursday. The Dow suffers its biggest percentage drop in 1987. Another Black Monday follows. March 19th, California issues a stay-at-home order. 34 states do the same by the end of the month. April the 2nd, the White House is asking Americans to wear a mask. In April, the devastating unemployment numbers come out. Then we move into May, and you think things might get calm. Au contraire. George Floyd on May the 25th dies after a policeman puts a knee to his neck. That is preceded by a shooting in Georgia. Then we have protests, riots, and looting after that. You think maybe June is a respite. Now on June the 13th, you have Rayshard Brooks, a black man in Atlanta, shot by police. So what I'm pointing to is that you have a timeline in 1968 that runs from January all the way to November. And right now, ours has been compressed into March, April, May, and June, 4 months. So I don't know if that makes for a more explosive electorate. I don't know if that makes for a difference in polling. So I'm just curious as to what you think, since so much is being thrown at this country so fast right now.
Trump's strategy seems to me to think it is 1968, and you know, running on law and order as Nixon did in 68 would be a winner. It was surprising to see the response to the Floyd killing doesn't look at all like 1968, where big majorities essentially reacted extremely negatively to violence, and it was a difficult problem for Democrats. I think the evidence on that's pretty strong. Here, most people seem to be dismissing the violence, saying a lot of it is caused by police rather than just demonstrators. The support for the demonstrations, at least the peaceful part of them, have been very high. As they become violent, the support decreases, but it hasn't fallen off the way it did in 1968.
Dave?
Yeah, I agree. It's entirely different time. First of all, it was the battles at the Democratic Convention, et cetera. The battles were really within the Democratic Party. Nixon said he was going to get us out of Vietnam and so on. So, and the law and order, Trump's the president. And that makes the law and order claim a little more difficult. By the way, one thing I'm finding is, you know, as you get closer to the election, when you ask the question about party identification, you get a lot of independents. But the closer you get to the election, the more people make up their mind and say, I lean Democrat or I lean Republican. One thing that's happening is the number of pure independents is decreasing and the number of people who say they're Democrats has increased. So the Democratic lead over the Republican Party has picked up a little bit, and that's helping to account for Biden's success. One other thing I'd say is on the COVID thing, among independents, on March 31st, among independents, 58% Trump was doing a really good job. That number's fallen by 30 points now. It's only 29%. And in the time that fell, the independent support for Biden increased so that now he's winning the independent vote. So I think COVID is still there. It hurt Trump, and I don't see how he gets around that.
Well, it seems to me you have these competing effects on voters right now. You have, first of all, uncertainty in the form of COVID, but then you have fatigue in the form of 4 years of Trump. So, yep. In theory, uncertainty should benefit, I guess, the incumbent because the challenger is the unknown. But fatigue would certainly favor Joe Biden. So, is fatigue winning out right now?
I think yes at this point, but it could turn. You know, the campaign's a long way to go. As Doug said, if these protests really got violent as they sort of did in the 60s, then I think after the Chicago convention, public opinion definitely turned really against violence. That could happen again, but I think the protesters have had a better handle on it this time than they did in 68.
Doug, do you agree?
The thing to remember is most people still haven't tuned into the campaign yet.
Yep.
So there was a little data coming from the polls, for example, showing that Biden was doing better among whites than Hillary Clinton had and was doing worse among African Americans and Latinos. That's largely just a sign that people haven't yet focused on the election. I guarantee you when the election comes around, Biden will do as well among blacks and Hispanics as Hillary Clinton did. And any inroads he makes among whites, I think, are going to be relatively small. Important, but not in the order of, you know, a 10% difference.
Well, Doug, at what point do voters start zeroing in on the election? Is it Labor Day? Is it 2 months out? 3 months? 3 weeks out? Give us kind of a rough timeline when you think things get serious for voters.
Yeah, so people like us will pay attention to the conventions, even if no one else does. But for the average voter, they really start to be aware that they need to make a choice for president. In September. Now, most people these days already, you can predict how they're going to decide eventually, but it's still the case. They don't think about it much over the summer. And then you'll have a series of events like the debates, presumably in October. And then it'll be the top story in people's minds. But we're just not there yet at the moment. It's the political junkies that are paying attention.
Well, right. I think essentially I agree with Doug, but I would say that if you had to make a prediction right now, we actually know how most voters are gonna vote because Republicans are gonna vote Republican and Democrats are gonna vote Democrat. So what you're really looking for, plus when you're looking at overall voting, but particularly in the battleground states, is so if all Democrats vote Democrat and all Republicans vote Republican, then there wouldn't be a problem, right? Pure independence, the 10% of people who are independent varies a little by state. They decide the election. But a second factor is you do get Democrats who vote Republican and a president and Republicans who vote Democrat. And that combination, even once you had this notion to turn the base vote out, that's the strategy, that percentage is between 15% and 20%, and those are the voters you have to watch. And I think there, Doug's absolutely right. Those are the voters that really kind of flop around, don't pay that much attention. And in the end, by the way, the voters who decided in the last two or three days in 2016, they went overwhelmingly to Trump. I think without that, he wouldn't have won.
So this junkie spent the weekend writing about Joe Biden's vice presidential options, his campaign campaign let out.
He must have really been bored, Bill.
It's a cry for help, clearly.
Not really.
Help me. No, he. So the campaign let it be known they're looking at six women. Biden in March having committed to putting a woman on the ticket during the Democratic debates. And so there's now a list of six, which means either he is indeed looking at one of these six women. And if you can name them, you probably need as much help as I do. Or is an elaborate head fake and someone's going to come out of nowhere to be the pick, kind of like Sarah Palin in 2008. But here's the question, fellas. Does the vice presidential pick really matter to voters? Do you see any kind of polling evidence that voters are looking at this because Joe Biden will be 78 years old after 17 days after the election? Donald Trump just turned 74 yesterday. There is a question about age. What I wrote about was just the question of bandwidth in terms of what he'll assign to the vice president. But given Biden's age, I'm just curious in general about how the age factor polls right now. Does that make people start looking at the person who's a heartbeat away?
I think they're going to look at the vice president a bit more carefully this time than they did, than they have in the recent past, for the very reason you suggest. But my view of that would be that if you're Biden and you're thinking about, so there's been a lot of pressure from the Sanders people, et cetera, to put more more people from the left in the Democratic Party on the relevant committees that are going to write the platform. Right. My view would be to say to them, you don't have to worry about that. The states those people dominate, they're going to win. My view would be to pick someone who's more, there's a point to say that I think he should not pick Elizabeth Warren. That I believe that would hurt.
Doug, I think the last time we talked about this, your polling showed that Warren was the, what, am I correct? Was she the most popular choice?
Indeed. Among Democrats, 30%, given a list of, I think we gave them seven possible women vice presidential candidates. She was by far the most popular pick. Kamala Harris is also doing fairly well among Democrats. But the question here is the vice presidential choice something Biden's going to make to placate the base or to try to win marginal voters? I'm not sure it will have either of those effects. I'm very skeptical about the impact of a vice president, even if in the case of a 78-year-old candidate, it probably should matter a lot more.
Right.
My guess is Biden wants somebody who will not cost him votes. This is an easy place to make a mistake. It's a hard place to gain a lot of votes.
I agree totally with Doug on that. So, and my comment about Elizabeth Warren fits that because she may placate some on the left, but she's going to annoy some of the moderate and conservative voters, and those and moderate conservative Democrats and independents in the are the ones that are going to decide who wins the battleground states. And my personal view is I don't think from the Democrats' perspective, I'm not saying anything, I'm just saying from his perspective, I think Elizabeth Warren would not be a good choice. And Amy Klobuchar is gone at this point. She's right in the bowl, but she's not going to get it because of what happened in Minnesota and her record as a prosecutor. She's gone. So I think probably the leading candidate at this point is Kamala Harris.
Right. So Warren is the only Caucasian of the six. There is one Latino who is Governor Lujan Grisham of New Mexico. The rest are African-American. The Warren pick is interesting in a couple of regards. First of all, do you gentlemen happen to know Elizabeth Warren's age?
72,
I think.
She's 67.
She is 70. She'll turn 71 this month.
See, I was closer, Rivers.
And you win.
Okay, you win that one, Dave.
We actually did some polling on this about, I don't know, 6-9 months ago.
And?
Because we found that people were very willing to say that Biden was too old. And most people correctly perceive Biden's and Trump's and Sanders' age. But the one person that they were consistently off on was Elizabeth Warren. Most people like me, this comes back to me now, thought she was in her 60s, not in her 70s.
Right.
Well, you didn't have the privilege. She was a professor at the University of Houston, as I was.
Well, that means she's really old because you were there a long time ago.
And I played that law school where she was, had a softball team, and we played the law school softball team many times.
It was exciting. It was exciting times, Doug. Texas just became a state, and everybody was quite excited.
I knew she was old because I knew her. Yes, that's right.
Yes. No, but I bring up Warren for this reason, because, Dave, you referred to a pressure point that Biden has to address. He has to address at least three. And yes, he has to address his viability in the upper Midwest states, which makes her problematic. He has to address the base as well. And then he has to address young voters as well. So he has these various competing concerns. So, Doug, you look at the polling data on Joe Biden. Where is he vulnerable right now? In other words, if you're making this calculation on the campaign, do I have to make a pick that gets African Americans more excited? Do I have to get the Bernie base more excited? Do I need to do the realpolitik, as Dave is suggesting, and address the flipper states? Where do you think he is weak?
Doug, that's you.
That's you, Doug.
Is he gone?
I think Doug is gone. Well, Dave, do you want to take it?
Yeah, I guess I take that. Well, I don't think he's weak among the African American vote because Trump's position where he stands on this issue at this point. Second, I think former President Obama is going to campaign very hard this time, and he didn't in 2016. Right. So I think he's going to campaign. So I would think on that demand, and I think chooses Kamala Harris, that's not a problem. I think his weakest place, in my view, is the group of Democrats that are most likely to vote against him. Okay, and I'll give you the data for the 11 battleground states. Mm-hmm. 14% of moderates in those states say they are thinking about will vote for Trump or they won't vote, et cetera, et cetera. So that's Biden's weakness in my view. And in the 16 states that you want to call them battleground states, even here, Biden's got 9 to 10% of people who say they're moderate or conservative who say they won't, they might not vote for him. And the point of that is very simple. The more moderate to conservative you are, they're a little stronger in their support for Trump. They don't dislike him as much as others. And that's the key for me, that's where he's weakest in the battleground states among moderate to conservative voters. If he moves too far left, that could be a problem.
All right. Do we have Doug back on the call?
I am. Okay. Technology problems are over, but I assume you've solved the election problem for us.
What I said was, I don't think he's going to have a weakness with African Americans. I thought his major point of weakness, and when I looked at the data on the 11 and 16 battleground states, by far the largest group of Democrats who say they're either going to vote for Trump or are not sure are Democrats who say they're moderate to conservative, and they don't dislike Trump as much as liberals and very liberals. So I think his main worry point is those people, particularly those in the battleground state.
Yeah, I think his probably single biggest challenge is turning out younger voters that voted in unusually high numbers in the 2018 midterms relative to what they usually do. The temptation, I think, is to pick a vice presidential candidate that will be viewed positively by that group. The problem is, I think that will hurt him in some of the battleground states.
Well, who do you think, which of the candidates out there are turning on young people? I don't see any of the people they've named. That young people won't even know who the other people are.
Warren would probably be the best bet there, right?
Warren, Stacey Abrams would be.
We have data on that for youth. I mean, we've got data. Look it up. I haven't looked that up. It may be right. I'm not saying.
No. We've done trial heats, and the one that younger voters like is Warren, that she did relatively well. But again, that's.
That could just be because I think,
The real way he's going to end up energizing that group is by running against Trump. That's going to be a much bigger factor in the end than who the vice presidential candidate is.
So that's a good question, fellas. Does he just have to run against Trump, or does he have to pile on things that the base wants to hear? Does he have to embrace a Green New Deal? Does he have to go large on defunding police or something like that? Or is it just as simple as saying you really hate Donald Trump?
Well, it's a delicate balancing act because he will scare off some suburban voters with the Green New Deal and the Medicare for All, which he's come out against and so forth. So far, he's largely managed to navigate those issues to convey to people that he was not an extremist on any of those. But that's what causes some trouble among the voters that preferred Sanders and Warren in the primary. Mm-hmm.
Dave?
Yeah, but again, my view of that is when you look at where those voters are, they're in California and in New York and in Illinois. They're not in states that are a problem for the Democrats. The huge number of the very liberal people who are Democrats in the United States live in California. Wow. It's going to be a really close election here, isn't it?
Well, I would say it might come in handy, though, in maybe Madison, Wisconsin, a college crowd like that. So maybe she plays there. Let me throw this idea at you guys. So among the greatest hits on the Bill Whelan campaign album is working on the 1992 Bush Quail campaign. You go to a reunion of Bush Quail people or Bush people in general, and you tell them you worked on the 92 effort, and they put an L on the forehead because that's the only nationwide one featuring father or son that managed to lose. So what a wonderful stigma that is. True story, it's happened before. Or maybe it's a reflection on me, I don't know. But anyway, in 1992, then President Bush was struggling on several fronts. The economy was in a recession. The Cold War was over, and that ended that narrative for Republicans for the first time in a long time. And he clearly was struggling for another 4 years. And so up came the idea, let's dump Dan Quayle over the side. That'll change things. And I'm about to ask you a question to which you're going to have a very quick answer, I think. But this is the idea. If you replace Mike Pence, and Nikki Haley seems to be the prominent answer here. If you replace Mike Pence with a Nikki Haley or put someone else on the ticket, would that really shake up the dynamic of this race?
No.
Well, I mean, would it shake up the dynamic in the sense that do I think it would make a difference in terms of how people vote in the long run? No. Do I think it would shake up the dynamic and it would give the Washington Press Corps and people who follow this 2 weeks of da-da-da-da, and would it give the Republican public relations people a chance to spin things a bit differently? Yes, I think it would do all those things. But I don't think it would have a huge effect on the election.
I think it might also cause...
Mike Pence is not Trump's problem. I mean, it would hurt him among his base. It would make him look weak, and it would pick up very few votes. I mean, it certainly would be a news story, so if he wants to change the subject again, that would work.
Yeah, and his numbers, Doug, I don't know if you have the numbers in front of you, but his numbers among Republicans are probably, I'm going to guess, what, high 80s in YouGov polls right now? So.
Yes, I'm right here.
It's not like he needs to bump the Republican vote. The problem is elsewhere. The problem is
he does a little bit on the following thing. And when we were doing the 2016 election, it was all along we thought that it looked as though there were going to be more Republicans vote for Hillary than vice versa. And in the end, it came down to more Democrats voted for Trump or voted for others, which was effectively the same thing. And this, in the last two or three YouGov polls, this is the first time that more Republicans are saying they'll vote for Biden than Democrats saying they'd vote for Trump. It's 7-4 now on the latest YouGov poll. But those numbers have been pretty consistently April, May, something like that.
So this decline in Trump support, which I think is really about 4 points rather than 8 points, is largely occurring among Republicans. You can see it in his approval numbers. The overall approval number has stayed relatively fixed. It's low 40s. Its high has been mid 40s. But he's gone down in the strength of approval. So the fraction of people saying they strongly approve among Republicans has gone down a bit. Biden has stayed more or less the same. So I think there's a good chance that these voters that are only temporary losses for Trump. His problem is that Biden is, running at about 50%, which Hillary Clinton never managed to reach in 2016. So he's polling worse than he did in 2016, and Biden is polling better.
I give you two examples of that. In regard to handling the COVID approval, you have 28% of moderate Republicans disapproving, 13% of conservative Republicans disapprove of his handling of COVID. On the overall job economy, it's very conservative people, overall job approval, 99% of the very conservative, 84% of conservatives, and 81% of moderates. And the same works for the economy. So I agree with Doug, and it's coming from the sort of the more moderate parts of the Republican Party.
Okay, gentlemen, final question for this podcast. Today is June the 15th. We are 140 days away from the election. We are also almost 2 months to the day from the Democratic National Convention, which has been pushed back to August 17th. Biden having said on Friday that he will go to Milwaukee and give an acceptance speech in some form, depending how that convention takes shape. Do you anticipate really much poll movement between now and August? I'm not saying this to get you off the hook for doing a July podcast, but if Biden is going to maintain a rather, shall we say, leisurely pace in this election, in other words, if he's ahead at this point, I'm not sure why he would suddenly change his strategy and start campaigning like a madman. Donald Trump will start campaigning like a madman, apparently. But if we look locked into this 5 to 10 point spread right now, do you really think it'll be that much different come August?
I don't see how, unless the riots really got bad, which I don't think they will, that's the only thing I could see that would really help Trump. Now, on the other hand, if COVID gets worse, imagine he has the rally in Tulsa, and out of that comes 300, 400, 500 cases of COVID. So I think for the president, there's a bigger downside than upside. And for Biden, doing nothing, he seems to be getting ahead. So,
yeah. Doug Rivers, typical of your many encounters with Dave Brady, you're going to get the last word.
So I don't expect much movement before the conventions, unless something big happens, which is often is the case in the Trump world. We expect that Biden will get a bump from the Democratic convention, even if it's held in an empty convention hall. And assuming that happens before the Republican convention, which is what the current schedule is. And then that will swing back the other direction with the Republican convention. But if I were betting, I would bet that we would be at about this place come Labor Day with a comfortable Biden lead, but not one that's insurmountable.
Okay, gentlemen, while we ended at that point, I'm headed to South Carolina in a couple weeks. Either you two want to join me, the bourbon's on me. I don't have an airplane.
Bill.
You're going to have to fly a commercial. I don't own an airplane. Maybe. Okay. All right, gents, thanks for a great conversation. Technical glitches and all. They said it couldn't be done, but we did it. We zoomed. So good talking to you, and hope to have you back on the podcast soon. Take care.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this podcast, a tumultuous election year that none of us saw coming. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe to us, and tell your friends to have a listen. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows, including Dave Brady and Doug Rivers, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's spelled @HooverInst. Dave Brady is not on social media, though apparently he can do Zoom meetings, but Doug Rivers is. Doug Rivers' Twitter handle is @Doug_Rivers. Rivers spelled as you expect it to be. We mentioned his fine polling firm, YouGov. YouGov's Twitter handle is @YouGov. That's spelled YOGOV. If you want to look at YouGov online, and you should because they do just all kinds of great polling in all sorts of cool directions, YouGov's website, YouGov What the World Thinks, is YouGov.com. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy. We'll do our best here at the Hoover Institution to help you stay informed. Take care.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.